Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, as you can see by the title of this one, we have a very popular returning guest in the form of Guy Speer of Aquamarine Capital. Now, Guy was actually a guest on the podcast earlier this year. Unfortunately, he was a little under the weather at the time, so we had to cut that episode slightly shorter than we had initially planned. But a big thank you to Guy for coming on to do a much longer episode. Guy is someone who I actually got to meet for the first time in person just a few weeks back in Omaha, Nebraska, where we both attended the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. So great to meet Guy in the flesh. Guy is a super nice individual, as you'll see in this episode, and it's no different kind of meeting him in person as well. And in this episode, we covered a hugely wide range of topics. Now, Guy, over the past few years, has built up this reputation for being extremely good at not selling. We often see some of his portfolio activity, and there's really not a whole lot. He's pretty good at basically just buying great businesses, minimizing the frictional costs of brokerage and paying taxes, and kind of shuffling around and amongst those companies, and he really just sits back and lets the great businesses do their thing. And we covered a couple of the key maybe lessons and experiences from the past that have potentially influenced Guy to behave in that way. You know, Guy shared a story on this episode that he's really never put out there in the public domain around one of the biggest mistakes that he made in his investment career, which was basically to sell a company after a significant price drop where the company was going through very real issues. But looking back at it now, if he had continued to hold that business, it would have been well more than a 100x return from when he sold those shares. So very interesting to hear that story from Guy, and very thankful to Guy for sharing that experience with the people that will watch and listen to this episode. And in the second half of this episode, I actually put a lot of your questions to Guy. So before going into this one, I collected a lot of questions from both YouTube and also Twitter. So we kind of just went through a Q&A type format and got Guy's thoughts on a whole range of topics. But for now, let's roll this episode with none other than Guy Speer. Guy, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great, and even better for being with you, Tom, and for having met you in real life in Omaha and having discovered that you're way taller than I expected you to be. But having met you once makes a big difference. I have a different impression of you. The funny thing is that I feel like you are more mature than I expected you to be. It's not just that you're taller, but I know something about your personality from your presence, the way you move around people, the way you interact with them. It just shows the benefit of being in real life with somebody rather than just being on a screen with them. There is a difference.
Yeah, for sure. It was great to get back to Omaha. Great to meet you in person. Great to meet a whole bunch of people. Actually, I was blown away at the number of people. Like, I came back and just looked at my bookshelf for a couple of minutes, and I was like, that guy was there, that guy was there, that guy was there, and probably knocked off about a third of the bookshelf, I think. So it's a pretty amazing thing that all of these people kind of congregate in one place in the world.
Well, pretty amazing for me is that people like you are there from New Zealand, and I've never been to New Zealand, and I haven't even been to Australia that often, but that I can come to Omaha and then hang out with you all the way from New Zealand. And that I think that the people who live far closer and don't travel to it, even though they expressed interest in Warren Buffett and value investing, as doing themselves in such a major way, it's really shocking and surprising to me how few people make it, given how beneficial it is for those who do. And I really appreciate you coming from New Zealand. I mean, that's like a two-day trip just to get into the general time zone.
It is a long trip, but it was definitely worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thank you for coming. And the funny thing is that I knew that I wouldn't have time to do what we're doing right now in Omaha. It would have been ridiculous. But I did say to Chantal that given the distances that I'm aware of from your side of the world, I said, well, he can always come visit us in Zurich. We'll put him up. And that's only a 10-hour flight, which is kind of like local for you when you're in Asia, you know?
Yeah, exactly. What was it like being back in Omaha after a three-year break? Because
I understand that you basically go every year kind of pre-COVID. Yeah. So what was it like after having a few years?
I mean, I have to confess that my first meeting was 1995. And then there were a couple of meetings in the late 90s that I missed. I cannot believe I did that. How did I do myself in? But then I've been pretty much in the 2000s, I went to every single meeting. I mean, you know, I think that Charlie Munger is right. It is a celebration. It's a celebration of so many things. But also, and I don't know if Charlie Munger would agree with me or not, it's more than a celebration. It's a pilgrimage. And, you know, I don't know a lot about pilgrimages, but a pilgrimage is about a journey to a place. It's about the changes in you on the journey to that place. It's about the people that you meet on that journey. Geoffrey Chaucer wrote a whole book, The Canterbury Tales, about the tales that people told on their journey to Canterbury, on their pilgrimage to Canterbury. And I think that, so for me, it really is a pilgrimage. I don't mind calling it that. I don't mind if people think that I'm part of a cult by saying that. And what do I mean by pilgrimage? It's a journey done with intent, and it's with the intent to become a different person as a result of that journey. And that's what I think that so many people who are just observers don't understand about the Berkshire thing. So it's not just that I got to meet you, Tom. It's that I and others. It's that I reinforce values that 25 years ago, and activities and behaviors and orientation towards the world that I only very, very vaguely perceived and grasped not very well. And I knew that I wanted that. And so how do you get that? Well, you undertake the pilgrimage. And through the act of undertaking the pilgrimage and being yourself, but engaging with it and being a participant in it, not just being an observer, then you know, so the bottom line, pilgrimages, when you pick the places that you do a pilgrimage to and the crowd that you do a pilgrimage with, that can change your life in ways that you cannot even imagine, which is why I deeply respect people. In a certain way, you had to make more effort to undertake the pilgrimage, if you describe it for yourself as a pilgrimage, but the benefits are even greater, if you like, because of the extra effort that was involved. And so, yeah, I mean, it was awesome. And it was lovely to reconnect with people that I hadn't seen for a long time, to be in the arena with Warren, to be hanging out in the queue on the Saturday morning very, very early. But what was even, and I think that one thing that I learned, I mean, I learned some things at the meeting this time, even though I've been to more than 20 meetings. But I think that something that I will do next time is I will actually be more conscious of this idea of pilgrimage and sort of say, what are the decisions that I want to take during my, quote, pilgrimage or my visit to Omaha? What are the things that I want to clarify in my mind? What is my intent? So when we set an intent before we do something, it's even more powerful. And so, yeah, it was awesome. And I think that, interestingly enough, the power of the meeting to impact somebody's life rises with time. And the reason why it rises with time is that every meeting, you know, more people. And it's those close human connections and bonds that and ties and relationships that actually create the change. And so, you know, imagining a kind of like a spider's web, the first time you go to the meeting, there's only a few strands of that web that have been woven. But every time you go, the strands that are already there get strengthened and new strands get woven. And so you become more, very, very much more firmly embedded. So it's hilarious for me, Tom, that today people, you know, I love this idea, seek not the masters, seek what they sought. So people kind of approaching me as if I'm somebody to emulate and follow and listen to. And I tell them, hey, don't seek me, seek what I've been seeking. But they perceive me as being so at the center of it. And 20 years ago, I was not at the center of that. The only other thing I would add, Tom, is that what's great about this pilgrimage idea is that we don't have to just do a pilgrimage to Berkshire Hathaway every year. We can undertake other kinds of pilgrimages. And I think that I've never been a Grateful Dead fan. And I've met a few, and I don't even understand the Grateful Dead's music. It's not something that appeals to me, but the few that I've met and those I've read about, for them, the Grateful Dead concerts and being a Deadhead is a kind of a pilgrimage. They were buying into a whole bunch of values and a lifestyle and a brotherhood and sisterhood. And there's nothing wrong with being, I actually think that probably being a Deadhead, there are things that conflict with being a value investor. But my point is that you know, if there's a festival, there's a music festival in Salzburg, a classical musical festival. And, you know, the people who attend that festival, quote, religiously every year, they're kind of dedicating themselves to music. Obviously, they're dedicating themselves to classical music, to a certain vision of European culture, to a certain vision of who they want to be. So we don't have to undertake just one pilgrimage in our lives. We can undertake multiple pilgrimages and select them in terms of who we want to become, you know? So many people go to the Edinburgh Festival. I mean, that's more of a kind of an arts festival, but, you know, people go to Varanasi in India. People who are not Hindus go to Varanasi in India. I don't fully understand that. It's not something that I'm close to. But my point is, if we cast out the idea of pilgrimage as being an old-fangled religious idea that is not relevant to us today, we're missing something about how human beings are put together. We're missing something about how we can act on ourselves to impact our destiny. And nobody's saying that we should undertake religious pilgrimages to Mecca or to Canterbury, or, you know, there's people who do this Santiago de Compostela in Spain. But, you know, pick your values, pick your heroes, and undertake that pilgrimage. You and I are part of the value crowd, so our pilgrimage is to Berkshire Hathaway, you know.
Yeah, I really like that. And I do owe you a thanks as well, Guy, for a couple of things. Firstly, for spending time with me on this podcast. And I know the audience really enjoys listening to you. But I also owe you a thanks because you very kindly invited me to the Aquamarine Fund dinner, which was a lot of fun. You had absolutely no obligation to do that. But thank you. I really enjoyed that.
Did you meet some good people?
I did, yeah. It was I met some good people throughout the entire weekend, really, from Matt Peterson's barbecue to In the Line to the dinner. But it's just great to be surrounded by a lot of people with similar interests, I guess.
I was bummed not to be at Matthew Peterson's barbecue, and I've co-hosted that with him in years past, but I was invited to a dinner with Warren Buffett's assistant, and that took priority for me. And
fair enough.
That was a lovely dinner. And I think that, I started off the first 5 years I went to the meeting. The only thing I do that I remember is go to Gorat's and meet random people at Gorat's, sit with random people and meet them. And so, you know, that was a kind of a, and then suddenly you get to a place where somebody invites you to a dinner, and you meet a whole bunch of really great people. And so that's kind of an acceleration. And suddenly you're no longer with a faceless crowd of 40,000 people. You're with, you know, old friends.
Yep.
And I was very happy to have you at the dinner. Thank you for coming.
Well, I really appreciate that.
Within 2 years, Tom, if you return, and I realize it's a huge way for you to come, You may well be in a position where you tell me, Guy, I would love to come to your dinner, but I've been invited to .. XYZ and I just have to go. I'm sure you'll understand. And I'll say, of course I understand, but that's very likely to happen, I can tell you.
Well, time will tell. We'll check in a couple of years.
Yeah, I think so.
Look, Guy, there's a few things that I've kind of got noted down here that I wanted to talk to you about. And then I've really just kind of put it out to the audience on YouTube, and I put up a tweet the other day kind of asking basically what's on people's mind and what they want to hear you talk about. So I think it'd be cool just to kind of spend a lot of time working through people's questions, really. But before we get to that, I mean, we were talking just briefly before we hit record here about some of the, I guess, I'm not sure how you want to describe it, maybe some of the valuation craziness that's starting to come back to earth, and a lot of people kind of having a bit of a tough time, particularly if they're tech investors or were invested in some of these high-flying growth companies. And you kind of said, you know, valuation still matters, it turns out. I was wondering if you could speak to that a little.
Yeah, I mean, for the listener, we talked a little bit about this beforehand. I'm going to, Tom, use a slightly different analogy. We can go back to what we talked about as well. But I'm not a good golf player. I don't play a lot of golf. But we all dream of getting, those of us who've played any golf at all, we all dream of getting onto the green, going to the, you know, hitting a drive that goes straight down the fairway and hits the, you know, lands on the green. We all dream of hitting those perfect golf shots. And golf is this strange game that even if you're not very good, as I am certainly not, every now and then, even somebody who's not very good hits a shot that looks like Tiger Woods could have hit it. And it's like, my God, I'm a freaking genius. And that's what we live for. And it makes us feel great. But the real game of golf happens when I take a sod of earth and the golf ball goes straight into the trees and it's just horrible and I've lost a ball and all of those things. That's where the game of golf really begins, actually. So this great friend who's actually an investor who comes to the Berkshire meeting, Aaron Bird, you should interview him. He's a lovely guy. He kind of got me into golf. He was an intern of mine. And sorry, while I go on about him, he's the guy who connected me to Warren Buffett. He said golf is a game of adversity. It's a game of managing adversity. The real game of golf, the inner game of golf, is, yeah, every now and then you get a celebration when you feel like you're Tiger Woods. But most of the time, it's managing that adversity that you get into. And so we can imagine, you know, when I buy Raffles Education Corp, which I did, I don't know how long ago, and it goes up 6x, that's like hitting that beautiful golf shot down the fairway. But that's not actually the game of investing. That's kind of like the icing on the cake. The game of investing is when you hit adversity, and we all hit adversity. So I think that the first thing that I would say to those people who are licking their wounds with some kind of either realized or hopefully unrealized losses in their portfolio is to realize that this is where the rubber hits the road. This is where things really get started. This is where you get the opportunity to prove your greatness. And to just reference, Marcus Aurelius says it so well. So forgive me if this is already well known to you. He's approached by one of his generals and he say, you know, it's so difficult. The enemy's so strong. Our troops are so tired. You know, our weapons are not as great. The weather's bad. The conditions are bad. So I might have to go out and fight this battle for you. And Marcus Aurelius's response to the general, in one of his writings and meditations, he says, oh, yeah, I understand. You want to be virtuous. You want to have fortitude. You want to have courage. But you don't actually want to prove them on the battlefield. You know, you just want to have those virtues. And life doesn't work that way. The way life works is that you actually have to prove those virtues in real life if you believe you have them. And so this is the opportunity to be heroic and to prove and discover the virtues that we have inside of us. And in a certain way, I think that it's sort of strange because we all have those virtues. So the virtues are ones of fortitude, patience, looking at reality in the eye, acknowledging our mistakes, making the best decisions today. And the key is that all we have to do is decide we want to have those virtues and then take those actions. And so the story that, for those listeners who are interested, that I told Tom, that I've told it privately, but I haven't told it publicly in this kind of forum. So, and I'm really happy to do it, is the story of my experience with Laboratory Corporations of America. You know, this all happened in the early 2000s. So there I was. I'd actually had the opportunity to shake hands with Lou Simpson, who was one of Warren Buffett's lieutenants, an extremely talented and capable investor who suddenly a new position appears in his portfolio, a company called Laboratory Corporation of America. And this was a merger between a company called BioReference Labs, which was partly owned by Roche in Switzerland, and National Health Labs, which was an American company. And this was the future of blood lab testing was high capital expenditures, but many, many tests, which would be very expensive and only capable of being done by the largest, most capitalized labs. And so this was clearly going to be one of the winners in a consolidating industry. and there was potentially one competitor emerging, and they'd taken a certain amount of, on a certain amount of debt to do the merger, and there was years of endless growth ahead of them. And then they had a, what I remember as a technical default on their debt, and the share price rapidly dropped from $8 a share approximately, which is where I had bought it, to $2 a share. And so at that point, so far so good, because that is just the normal course of business in the stock market. Things happen. Things don't always turn out the way you expect them to. The last 5 or 6 years has been a very unusual period. And again, that's where the rubber hits the road. And for the benefit of the viewer, I made a number of really big mistakes or a number of errors that I would prefer not to have made. So first of all, nothing other than a quotational loss, and you're talking about 75% loss on my purchase, which is about what some people have in some of their SaaS tech businesses. And but nothing else had happened. Nobody was yelling, "You idiot." Nobody was telling me to sell the shares. I don't know what would have happened when I reported to investors, if I would have gotten redemption requests or not. But at this point, none of that has happened. So a first mistake is that I went into a funk. All I could do was think about this company. I had other companies in my portfolio, but all I could do was think about this company and how much money I'd lost on a quotational loss. And in this case, the bankers were Credit Suisse, and they had a very close relationship with Roche. And they took a penalty from the company, and they modified the loan agreement. So it wasn't like the company was about to go into Chapter 11 or anything like that. It had a solid set of shareholders who were totally capable, if necessary, of recapitalizing the company. But that wasn't even necessary. They just needed a modification on one of the sort of covenants on the loan, as I remember. In any case, I couldn't think of anything else. And eventually the pressure came too great for me, and I sold the shares at $2 a share and felt so much better afterwards because the position was cleared out and I didn't have to think about it anymore. And that was that. And I tried to forget I ever owned it and tried to forget that I ever bought it. 5 or 6 years later, I discovered that Chieftain Capital Management owned shares of the company. I don't remember the name of the guy leading it, of kind of like buy and hold long-term investors. In any case, the results for the company were that it was more from the $2 a share, it ended up at more than 100 or 200x, perhaps even more. It's too painful for me to do the study. The most profound fact about that is that if all I had done was done nothing, if I just held on to my shares at $8 a share, I would have made a lot more than 20 times my original investment. 20 times. My original analysis was right. All I had to do was sit there and do nothing, and I failed to do that. So in retrospect, did I pay too much for the company? Perhaps at that particular moment, and I bought into the flush of excitement at the merger and the fact that Lou Simpson had bought a bunch of shares, and I bought in the midst of enthusiasm, but then I doubled down on that mistake by selling it at the wrong time. And so, you know, I think that many investors right now are waking up to realize that they've made the mistake of overpaying. But I think that in many cases that I know of, they've actually bought into some extraordinary businesses. And what Charlie Munger says is that often the pain in the markets happen not because of a bad idea, but because of a good idea that was taken too far. And so many of these companies are extremely well managed. They have some super high quality people running them. They are, not all of them, but some of them, and perhaps many of them, are extraordinarily good businesses. I believe that those people that I know who are invested in them have done good research, excellent research, beyond excellent research. And yes, perhaps they've paid too much for them, which is easy to see now. But it would be a great shame to compound that mistake by selling at the wrong time, if you like. And so that was a signal lesson to me. And perhaps that is helpful for some people who are sort of licking wounds right now And the one other thing that I would share that is, doesn't originate from me, but this concept of freezing a position, of saying, you know what, this is extraordinarily painful for me. I can't believe it's gone down so much, but I'm aware that, so the, what I say for myself is, I understand now from my experience in Laboratory Corporation of America, how I was actually, I sold irrationally. But in the moment when I sold, I didn't believe I was being irrational. So the emotional brain is so powerful that it can convince the rational brain that, the emotional brain will take over the rational brain and convince the rational brain that's acting rationally when actually it's the emotional brain that's taken over the steering wheel. And one way to avoid that kind of mistake is to just say, you know, when I'm feeling this extraordinary pain over a quotation loss, for example, I'm not going to allow any action, period. I'm just going to freeze it. I'm just going to do nothing. And that's just the way it's going to be. And it's fascinating to me how the people who seem to do the best in the markets are the people who do less. And so to find ways to convince ourselves to do less is a good thing. And this period there'll be a lot of people who stop talking about their portfolios, who quietly go out of business. But if those, but I urge those of you who are listening, who are determined to stick around, this is your opportunity, not to shine necessarily, but to survive. And sometimes surviving is enough, you know, and don't set too high standards for yourself. This is an extraordinary difficult thing. And sometimes surviving is thriving. How did I do, Tom?
That was great. I appreciate you sharing that, Guy. I see a lot of people kind of, you know, sharing your 13 Fs and things and referring to you as the master of doing nothing. I think maybe not quite rivaling Charlie, but, you know, aspiring to that level, I think. And I can see that maybe those past experiences have kind of seared that in. I know you're an extensive user of checklists as well. Are those experiences you just described, was that sort of the genesis for setting up investment checklists also?
So one thing is that people are focused on the 13 Fs, but they're not aware of what I have outside of the US, which I'm quite happy not to share.
I don't Fair enough. Have to.
And, Fair enough. But for what it's worth, you probably, if you look in India, you'll see me as showing up as a shareholder, at least in a couple of companies. But interesting enough, I haven't made any moves there either. So the portfolio has stayed pretty static through this period. I think that, you know, actually a big change for me is that my letters can now be read by everyone. So you're welcome to go read those letters. And I think that, you know, I'm almost hesitant. It's not that I'm hesitant. This is kind of like the big secret for me, or a big secret that's been revealed to me recently, is that William Green, in talking about Nick Sleep, in Richer, Wiser, Happier, talks about destination analysis. Look at where you want to end up and then rewind from there. And I think that there are so many businesses that I've watched friends of mine own where I just say, I can't see the destination. It looks really sexy right now, but what's the destination? And if the destination is not somewhere that I want to be, then I'm not going to invest in it. And I just have to take a mating analogy, human mating analogy. So, you know, if, I don't know, are you single, Tom?
No.
You're not single. Are you married?
Married? No. I'm not married.
No? Okay, partnered up. So, but the thing is that I experienced when I was way younger, maybe many of us have experienced the thing of the one night stand or the, you know, drunken night in a bar. And then there's a kind of the wolf syndrome where you want to bite your arm off because you find your arm off somebody underneath somebody that you really don't want to be around the next morning. That is an example of not engaging in destination analysis. An example of engaging in destination analysis is to only hang out and certainly only go home with people you'd want to spend the rest of your life with, because then the destination is a positive destination. You never ever in investing want to wake up and discover that the thing that you thought you were getting married to really ought to have been a one-night stand. And so every single company. And I've done this with companies where people say this is a spectacular business and they're making so much money and they're not that expensive. And my answer to them is yes, but I don't know where the end point is. I don't know where they end up. And I want to know where they end up. And when you know, when you, every single company in your portfolio is one where I can see my way to an end point that is a good and positive end point that I want to be in, then that's something that you want to own for life. That's something you want to be married to. And so people in this period are waking up to, you know, to use the analogy that they took home somebody as a partner, and then they're waking up the next day and it ain't looking so good anymore and they want to chew their arm off. And what you really want to do is make sure that whatever, you know, company you take home with you to get is one that you actually want to get married to. And you know, every single company that's in my portfolio, I want to be married to that company effectively. And so why would I change? And I, you know, it's actually, the letter was really, really well timed, because I talked about going into inflation and higher interest rates in a time of extraordinary uncertainty. And I asked myself, and I asked the reader, you know, where do you want to be as you go through this period? And the answer, and I reasoned through to an answer, which basically says, you want to be in these businesses. And, you know, maybe there's a selection of the businesses that you want to, this is where you want to be. And, you know, just very briefly, I used the analogy of, if we just imagine all stock investing is real estate, if you already own the best real estate in town, you own the best office building, you own the best McDonald's franchise, you own the best shopping mall right down there next to Trump Tower, let's say, and the storm is coming, whatever it is, do you really want to go and buy warehouses on the edge of town? Do you really want to sell your real estate and buy and hold cash or anything else? Or do you want to continue to own? Sorry, there's something in my throat. Hopefully that takes care of it. Or do you want to own the best assets you can possibly find? And my answer is to own the best assets I can possibly find. And so that's why there's zero portfolio turnover. In terms of checklists, I don't think that the checklists have helped me to lower my portfolio turnover. I think it's really this concept of destination analysis, knowing where you want to end up and not doing anything that is inconsistent with that outcome, which basically means that 98% of possible actions in the stock market are ones that you end up not taking for that reason. You know, I'll give you one example that, and I hope I'm not pouring fuel on a burning fire, but, you know, if I was a trader type, what I'd really like to do right now is short Tether, because I think that, you know, in the crypto world, and I know I've just made a whole bunch of crypto enemies right there. but the destination, there's no conceivable good destination from that. So I'm not going to do it for all sorts of reasons. But there are many examples of that. You know, I was so. I was looking at a company called Basic Fit. Basic Fit appears to be a phenomenal business. They run low-cost gyms in Europe, and it's really well managed, and it's a good business. It generates a lot of free cash, and it's got scale economies, and they're going good places, and the valuation was suppressed because all sorts of growth aspects of the growth of the business were heavily dampened by COVID and lockdowns. But I don't know where that business ends up. I don't know what happens to health clubs in 20, 30 years. Maybe we're all working out at home. I've no idea. So it's just a no-go for me, even though I'm probably going to leave, at least for a 5 or 6 or 10 year period, a lot of money on the table. And I think that something that really, you know, this is another one of the reasons why we go to the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. So during the financial crisis 10 years ago, I discovered that Berkshire Hathaway had loaned money to Harley Davidson. And Harley Davidson was a brand that I really like. It's an iconic brand. You know, there's this wonderful statement that if you know, any brand that gets tattooed into people's arms is something that you want to own. I mean, that's kind of pretty amazing. And then it was just phenomenal for me because one of the shareholders asked the question. They asked to Warren and Charlie, we saw that you had bought some kind of debt issuance of Harley Davidson. Did you consider buying the equity? And I kind of at the time would have thought that Harley Davidson would be the kind of brand that Berkshire Hathaway would love to buy. And Warren said something along the lines of, we're not so sure where the brand ends up, but we felt pretty confident that the debt was well covered and safe, and it was offering a nice rate of interest. And, you know, so I think that Warren, again, there's no lesson that I've learned that I don't realize that Warren hasn't already learned it. And I think that he was engaging in a kind of destination analysis. And it's not enough for Warren to say, you know, to enjoy the idea that it's tattooed into people's arms and it's a well-known brand. No, he really thinks through to saying, is this something that will be around after the flood, after the apocalypse? You know, and I think that his conclusion was no, but the secured debt was something that was okay to invest in, but the equity was not. And so one should have extraordinarily high standards about that destination. Now, the reason why I was hesitant is that I don't want everybody to think that way, because that will take away opportunities for me. But, you know, we have to be open, and we have to teach, and we have to be generous. So I'm doing it for that reason. And I realize that half of the, you know, something I learned from Monish, you can give your secret sauce away and people still won't implement it in their own lives. So, you know, and the world is big, but yeah, so that's really the reason why the zero turnover. I like what I own other than, I sold Twitter, you know, which was, yeah. And I worry about saying that, and I already said it on Twitter, because I don't want to start justifying every portfolio move in a podcast or elsewhere. But but I'm and for what it's worth, I'm feeling unbelievably smart, because I feel like I called it right. And the bottom line was what I said, so the story of my Twitter investment was that at the very beginning of lockdown, when I saw these businesses valuations go through the roof. So lockdown kind of accelerated a whole bunch of businesses that we know: Netflix, Peloton, Zoom. And I kind of had not owned any of these new economy businesses. And I understood that they were good businesses, and I didn't like the valuations. And I just said to myself at the beginning, around the beginning of lockdown, you know, you have to at least own some of this to understand what it feels like to own it. And so one of the companies I bought, or the only company I bought, was Twitter. And the reason why I bought it, I'd never paid such a high valuation. I was paying, I believe, about 10 times revenues. I'd never paid such a high valuation for a company. And I kind of, you know, my kind of like desire is more like 50% of revenues or less,
yeah,
something like that. You know, at the point
those
at which I bought
Fiat Chrysler days. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That's more my style. But I said, hey, you got to learn, and sometimes it's not enough just to watch. So why don't you just put some money into this and see what it looks like? And what I said to myself about Twitter was that I could see and understand how extraordinarily influential the platform was, even if that wasn't translating into cash flows. And I believed, as I guess Elon Musk believed, that there were things that you could do with the platform to really make it shine. And so I bought it, and I round tripped the share price. So the share price doubled, didn't pay a lot of attention to it. So at that point, it was more or less 20 times revenues. And then it went back to around my purchase price. Then Elon Musk made the offer to buy it. And what really shocked me, I love the fact that Elon Musk was making the offer to buy it, because I felt like his analysis coincided with mine. But what shocked me was that the company was so quick to say yes and to sign an agreement with him, which led me to believe that they were actually out of ideas and they were out of potential buyers. It really surprised me that, you know, when LinkedIn was available for sale, if my memory serves me right, Salesforce and Microsoft were both very interested in the company. And it would have been an extraordinary acquisition for Salesforce had they bought it. Microsoft ended up getting it. And if it hadn't been Salesforce and Microsoft, there are at least a few other businesses that would have been very happy, I think, to bid on it and to own it. Maybe IBM, maybe Oracle, and perhaps others that I'm not even thinking of. And what, you know, so people who know way more than me did not want to bid on Twitter. Facebook didn't want to bid on Twitter. LinkedIn or Microsoft didn't want to bid on Twitter. What's going on there? Why? And so I realized that if the Elon Musk bid fell through, which I thought was very likely, because I think Elon Musk is utter genius, a gift to humanity, but also highly erratic, then, you know, they'd be at the dance with no, they'd have nobody to take them to the dance. In a certain way, they'd have no clothes on, because the fact that there was no competition on Elon Musk's bid revealed that there's some serious issues with the business that restrained the Microsofts and the Salesforces and the others, the Facebooks of the world, from wanting to bid on them. And so, you know, it's one of the few times when I kind of said the people are enthusiastic, now's the time to set into that enthusiasm, and I actually got it right. And so I'm patting myself on the back a little bit, because that's a bit of a, you know, every now and then, if you spend enough time on the golf course and you keep whacking, you'll take up a lot of sods of earth, but every now and then you'll actually hit a good ball. So I'm feeling good about it.
Well, it's always nice to mix those in. And, I must say that the destination analysis was probably the main sort of lesson I got from reading Nick Sleep as well. But I hadn't heard an analogy that good on it before, Guy. So the mating one. So I'm going to borrow that.
You know, I mean, what I would tell you is that we kind of shy away from analogies between, you know, mating behavior, human mating behavior, and business, because it's quite fraught with the potential for, you know, sexual harassment suits and you name it, and being named a male chauvinist or whatever else. But I think that, and this is a thought that I originally got from Anthony Robbins, the analogy is extremely powerful, and there's enormous amounts that one can learn from looking at, you know, mating strategies, human mating strategies. And I actually think that many of the people, and I guess I won't say all, because the world is a vastly complex and variegated place, but many of the people who are very successful in business, I believe, are either happily married or in a happy relationship. And then, you know, where does that sexual energy go? And if you can channel that sexual energy into business, and you find a way to do it effectively, then there are enormous rewards and results. And so, you know, Warren Buffett, he kind of said during the 1974 market crash that at the end of it, he was like, everybody's depressed, but I feel like a sex up man in a harem. You know, so he's using the analogy of, you know, in a certain way, when he's buying shares of a company, I mean, that's the analogy that he used, and it's a good one, you know. And the people who in business have a glint in their eye, and they have a kind of a fun playfulness to them, they're channeling sexual energy into business, which is, it's when we connect up to those deep motivations that we can actually shine. So I encourage more of your listeners to do that in a positive way, you know.
So there you go. I didn't think we'd get on this tangent when we first hit record, but I don't mind it. So yeah. One of the other, I was actually just reading the your annual letter that you mentioned is now publicly available. I've been reading bits of that over the last couple of days, and one of the interesting sections in there was talking about, I believe you titled it something like two companies I bought and one I didn't, talking about BYD and yeah. Indian Energy Exchange, and like a French lottery company, which I'm blanking on the name on, but I think there were some interesting
Federal des Jeux.
There you go. I think there were some really interesting lessons in there as well. There were sort of a couple of key things I got out of that. There were kind of position sizing. I think that's something we covered in the previous podcast that people really got a lot of value out of, the whole analogy of whether the water's up to your ankles or your knees or your chest or over your head or that sort of thing. And it was interesting to see that you size those positions in the case of BYD and IEX at around 5%, I think, you know,
a little under five, actually.
Yeah. But at a size where it's going to be meaningful if you're right. Yeah. And I guess it doesn't keep you up at night.
Really important. Yeah. Really, really important. Yeah, and I agree.
I mean, looking through the fund now, I mean, I don't want to go through all individual positions and stuff, but a company like BYD has grown to be very significant for the fund.
It's true.
Is that still the approach that you would take today? I mean, the BYD investment, I think, was something like 11 years ago now. Do you still have that same sort of philosophy about opening these new positions?
You know, so this guy, Steve Goldstein, interviewed me for MarketWatch. And it's really funny because he kind of picked up on this low to zero portfolio turnover. And the first statement, which I kind of really enjoyed from the conversation, was that I said to him, pathetic, isn't it? he quoted that.
It's value add, I think.
Yeah, so I cited to him this study. Maybe someone listening to this can, or you can actually identify or find the real story. So he didn't bring this up in the conversation, but then he wrote that it's attributed to Fidelity, but Fidelity has no knowledge of it. So I don't know. This might be a kind of an old wives' tale, and that's terrible, by the way, if that's true. So first of all, if it's true that it's just a kind of like a rumor or that circulates, it's a story. What do you call those stories that aren't actually true, but everybody believes they're true because they've been circulating so long? And I don't really want to be somebody who participates in that. I think we all have an obligation to keep us grounded in reality. And if that's not a true story, that's terrible. And maybe somebody here can look it up and tell me and correct me if I'm wrong. So there I am crowdsourcing my knowledge through you, Tom. I love it. But the story is that the portfolios of dead people perform. So now I'm repeating it. And I just really hope there is some basis and fact in it. The portfolios of dead people perform better than the portfolio, many portfolios of live people. And the answer is because they are static. They don't do anything. And the bottom line is, some companies go bankrupt, many companies do nothing, but one or two are runaway successes and those carry the whole portfolio. And if that's true, then what we want to do is not risk a lot for a little. The opposite, we want to risk meaningful amounts, but where each amount, because we don't know which bucket it'll fall into. Well, the investment that we make, obviously we make the investment hoping it's going to be a multi-bagger, but we don't know, we can't predict. So we need to be aware that there's a certain chance that it will go bankrupt. There's a certain chance that we'll do nothing. But we need to be in a position that if God willing, if we're really lucky and it's number three, then we can hold on to it for a long time. So what we want to do is we want to risk enough that it's meaningful, but not so much that it wipes us out. And by the way, wiping us out does not just mean on a portfolio basis. It also means psychologically. In Laboratory Corporation of America, I was wiped out psychologically. I allowed myself to wipe myself out in that position psychologically. It was a psychological wipeout, not a financial wipeout. You just want to keep making these bets that are meaningful and allowing them to unfold the way they unfold, which of course is one of my big takeaways from Berkshire, is that this is all that Warren's doing all day long. And he's doing it both in private businesses and in public businesses. And some of them worked out spectacularly well. And some of them don't, you know. And if they don't, they don't. That's okay. You know, and that doesn't mean the people are bad. Doesn't mean, you know, your process is a good process. So for me, that's the 5% is a great place to be. Great place. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that still holds for me. And I think it's kind of probably a formula of success for the rest of one's life, actually. Yeah.
Right. I think this might be a good opportunity to maybe transition into some of these YouTube questions, because we've got an interesting question which I think kind of ties into this discussion. And the question basically goes, if you were to start again, would you focus on compounders from the start, or would you take even the same philosophy to position sizing if you were to start from a very small capital base?
Yeah, I would definitely focus on compounders. I think it's a spectacular place to be. And I would not just be looking in the tech space. I'd be looking everywhere. And there's lots of evidence that the compounders can come from many different places. And what a great way to live and invest, you know? Absolutely. And so I did inadvertently have some of those. Some I ridiculously sold, like Crizzle, which was just a huge mistake. Some I had taken out of my portfolio against my will, like Duff and Phelps. But some I managed to hold on to. You know, BYD would be one, Berkshire would be another. Moody's would be another, MasterCard would be another. And, you know, you don't need a many of them for your life to be a financial success. So it's a really, really good way to go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I did, that's not all I did. So I played around with Japanese net nets and I owned shares of Eurotown. I owned debt credit of Eurotunnel, and so I did a bunch of other things which didn't work out as well.
Right. You know? We've got another interesting question here. This is from Gage Sanchez, again from YouTube. He says, we often hear value investors discuss the emotional and mental fortitude needed, which is absolutely critical, he said. But where does Guy advise we look for the technical and fundamental skills needed to analyze and value businesses?
Yeah, so if I just stay with the emotional fortitude, I think the only thing that I would add to that is that don't make it difficult for yourself. The answer is not find yourself in a position where you're challenged mentally and emotionally and then try and plow through that. The challenge, the goal is to never put yourself in this situation where you're challenged mentally and emotionally. And that's got all to do with destination analysis, position sizing, which businesses you're in. So don't look for the very thing that you're fearful of and then put yourself where you're fearful of it and you're actually in that position and then life sucks. That's not the goal, if you like. You know, the answer I want to give on the technical side is, my apologies to whoever asked the question because it's kind of snarky. And the answer is, if you got to ask the question, then maybe you're in the wrong thing. Because, if your mind is capable of that, of it, your mind will naturally find it. And if you're asking where to look, you know, it would be like, and this is just, it's riffing on something that Charlie Munger said. If I go to Mozart and I say, hey, I want to get the technical knowledge as to how to compose symphonies, where do I look for it? And it's like, you know, Mozart's answer is, you screwed, man. So, you know, I just think that, so maybe that's too snarky, but, you know, there's a guy who asked me today, he tweeted to me, and he said, I answered it. He asked me, what's a book that I can read that will teach me about insurance and banking? And my answer was, in a certain way, I had the same feeling. I was like, if you're asking me about what book to read about insurance and banking, then, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree, because the answer is not in one book. And so, you know, what I told him was, I said, look, read everything by and about. I gave him four names of people in insurance and banking. I gave him Warren Buffett, Tom Gaynor, Charlie Munger, Jamie Dimon, Brian Moynihan. And I said, you know, read everything you can that's been written by them and read everything that is written about them. So, you know, in the case of Warren Buffett, you've got at least two or three biographies and, you know, you've got all the annual letters of the Berkshire Hathaway. And then you can dive in, you know, Rockford Illinois Bank. You can go and read all of their annual reports. And, you know, and then when you're done, or if you, you know, add anybody relevant that you come across along with any institutions relevant that you come across. So, you know, I think that's a pretty good program. And maybe it's helpful for that person to tell them what you need to learn you're not going to find in the textbook. So if you think there's some university textbook that's going to give it to you, the university textbooks are written by professors who are writing for a very different reason. But my answer to all of those people is, read everything, you know, and read intelligently. Read the first thing that's in front of you. And if it's, you know, if you know the stuff that's in there, then spend less time on it. If you don't know the stuff that's in there, then spend more time on it. And then acquire new reading, new stuff to read, and just keep freaking going, you know? And so there's no shortcuts. I don't know if that's and the answer on the technical knowledge is start, you know, so this is, sorry, I'm getting all sort of like, start with the A's. You know, yeah. What does that mean? Start with what's in front of you and just keep going. You know, I don't know if, you know, I travel around with, I mean, I don't want to try and move the camera, but this kind of might be interesting. So I just got to London, and my assistant's here with me this time, and she had to travel with 30 kilograms worth of printed out documents. So, you know, what is on my read? And this, I got like sort of piles and piles. You can see these piles behind me. You know, this is, I don't know, Tom, stop me if this is not relevant, but I got a transcript here of Kindrel. It's an interview with a research service called Tegus. Mm-hmm. So I kept this thing from the Financial Times, How Trump's Reshaped the Courts. I wanted to reread it. I'd read it once. Ben Thompson, he writes Stratechery. He wrote in 2017 something called the Local News Business Model. I've read it once. I kept it to reread. The document's marked up a little bit. This is also by Ben Thompson, Tech and Liberty, written in 2019. What do we have here? This is the Lex column from FT Weekend on Royal Estate, Crown Estate, Royal Docks. You know, Jeremy Deal, you interviewed Jeremy Deal. I got Jeremy Deal's letter on Spotify here. So I'm reading his letter on Spotify. I've already read it, but I'm rereading it. Here we have, I'll stop in a minute. I have a guy called Nick Martin that I met through Tom Gaynor at the Markel brunch. I met him there in Omaha. I want to meet him for a coffee in London. He runs a fund called Polar Capital. You know, on the back, this is kind of the fund tear sheet. He's got listed here. I guess this is public knowledge because it's published. So, you know, I see Chubb, Marsh, McLennan, Arch Capital, Markel, and various other companies. A company called Essent Group. You know, R1's annual report. Sorry, should I keep going, Tom?
This is great. I know that people enjoy. You know, one of the comments we got on the last podcast is, I just really enjoy this casual conversation where, you know, guys throwing up his notebook on the screen, you know, it's great.
So I'll do just a little bit more here. Here's a book that I ripped apart, Something on Responsibility. I decided to reread it. And here's an economist that I didn't get to. Some real estate stuff that, you know, I thought maybe it'd be nice to look at houses in Zurich. So there's a company called Power Grid. It's an Indian company. I got a bunch of printouts. Then I got annual reports from this is an Indian company called POSICO annual report. So you know, I'll do one more is Moody's Investor Day presentation. And now I'm making a mess on my desk. What's my point to you know, if you think that you need technical knowledge, go buy a university textbook and read the whole frickin' textbook, or stop reading the textbook when you find something else, or put it aside. And I'll just share it because I think I've kind of figured this out, and maybe we'll save some people. So literally, the stuff that I've got to read will go on the right of me. So when I'm done with this, I'll just show you. You know this. Swiss company guide. This is kind of like a value line for Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And so I'll put it on the right. I'll read. I'll mark up. I will then put it into some of it will have action required. So I'm responding to something, or I want to order more materials, annual report, or some of it will be to read later. So I'll kind of like take things like I may take the POSICO annual report, mark it up. This is printed out, and then I'll get rid of extraneous pages, but I might keep the letter, the investor letter, for example. And then I put it back for my future self to read at some future date. So I'm kind of like reminded of it. And then mm-hmm. I'm writing stuff up in various places. I write stuff up in Evernote. I write stuff up in Rome Research. I keep notebooks, so I have usually Moleskine notebooks. I also write stuff in. I write stuff in on 3x5 cards. But the whole point of all of those things is basically taking care of my future self, giving my future self something to read. So my answer to somebody who says, where do I get the technical knowledge, is You know, sorry, one last thing. I know I'm kind of like, I'm on a bit of a roll here, is I will never forget during the first or the second Gulf War, I don't remember which it was, a general called Norman Schwarzkopf, and he's in a press conference, and he said, yes, we've invaded Kuwait, and we're going to take it back from the Iraqis. And he had a map behind him, and the journalist says, you know, we're curious, did you go by sea or did you go by land? Did you go, you know, did you do a flanking movement around? You know, and Norman Schwarzkopf, who's a kind of like a very powerful and strong personality, looks straight at the journalist and he says, he doesn't say, sir, but you kind of, I imagine him saying, sir, we're going over, under, around, on top, every which way that you can think of, we're doing it, which is kind of in a certain way saying, when I'm not answering the question, because that might be a military secret, because the operation was ongoing, but it's also saying every which way, you know? And so this is a very long answer to the question, but I would just also add one more thing, Tom, and it's, I'm keeping going because Tom's smiling, so I presume that's okay to go on. So when I was about 22, I went on a kayaking trip with I went in the Durance Valley, and I was interested in kayaking, and I didn't know much about kayaking, and I went through a day or so of training how to go through whitewater rapids in a kayak. And one of the exercises was that you sort of sat on land on a berm of soil about, you know, 3 meters above the river, not whitewater river, just sort of like calm water. And you literally, sort of, he came to sort of throw you off so that the kayak would land in a random way, and hopefully you'd find a way with your paddles to gain your balance and to go to a floating position with you in the kayak. Of course, if you got it wrong, you could end up underwater and climbing out of the kayak. But it was kind of like a preparation. So he's about, the teacher's about to sort of push me off the berm and into the water. And I say, wait, what do I do when I hit the water? And as he's pushing me off, he says, you improvise, you know? And so, you know, so my answer is improvise. Get what's in front of you. Yeah, you know, you got the idea. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, no, I like it. This question might be along similar lines, but yeah. It's quite a long one. I'll try and shorten it up here. But it's kind of to the effect of, when you're evaluating a company, how much time would you spend sort of right in the micro focusing on that particular company versus the general industry? And I mean, rightly or wrongly, people tend to generalize entire countries sometimes. China's quite a topical one at the moment. How do you think about balancing that kind of microeconomics versus the broader kind of setting where that business operates?
I mean, I don't think about it in those terms at all, which okay. is fine. I think that's a very structured way of thinking of it. It's kind of putting things into neat buckets, you know, macro versus micro, for example. Mm-hmm. How much time do you spend? And I think that the world's way more confusing and complicated than that. I think that the way I see it is that I'm trying to, so the amount that one can know about the world, the amount that one could know about any particular company is kind of in a certain way infinite. It's way more than any human could spend a lifetime on. You know, I spoke to somebody about one of our Indian positions. She'd done like a week or two's worth of reading, and literally 8 hours a day reading documents from publicly available websites in India. And then she'd gone and taken about a week to do an incredible write-up, which may end up going out in one of my email newsletters. And and then we spent like 2 hours talking about it, and we'd barely scratched the surface. And I'm doing this full time, and that's just one company, and I had her help. And so the amount we can know about the world, about any specific situation, is infinite, let alone the whole world. And I think that the way I see it is that within that infinity of potential knowledge and a potential axes of exploration, I am constantly trying to push back the boundaries of my understanding. And, you know, I may be foraging around, if we take the, imagine that it's sort of like this is kind of in a rainforest. I may be foraging around, examining one particular part of the rainforest and developing an incredibly detailed knowledge until I realize that actually my efforts are better spent in some other area. And so, and then if you kind of like, what am I doing? I am looking and examining things all the time, and I'm trying to work out, I'm trying to learn from what I'm looking and examining. I'm trying to hold on to things that might be useful for a later date, and I just keep going. And there are things that will happen, like I might categorize, you know, so to say all macros useless, for example, which is something that Warren has said, maybe in that very broad brush stroke, true. But there may be some people who are classified under macro who are particularly interesting to read. I find myself profoundly disagreeing with pretty much everything that Paul Krugman says, but I think that he's worth reading. And I think that by contrast, I find myself agreeing with just about everything that Larry Summer says, and I think that he's worth reading. But let's say there's a category of macro commentary that comes from fund managers, and I find none of that useful. So I discard that pretty quickly, except I continue to read it when it comes across my desk, because maybe somebody's talking about something different, or maybe I learned something. And I cannot categorize how much time I'm spending on any particular thing. And, you know, you saw that I have this Tegas thing up. So I've suddenly discovered Tegas, and I do find Tegas useful. So suddenly there's a new avenue of exploration that I can use. And I sort of think, well, how about using Tegas to kind of learn more? But then I also email people or message people on LinkedIn to see if I can learn more about a particular industry from them. Or I'll have somebody, or I will write up a white paper or some thoughts on it, and I'll send it out in an email, or I'll put it out on Twitter to see what, you know, sort of like to engage this idea of learning in public, where you share what you've learned and then you see what you get back. And I get messages in from people on Twitter. I got a message in from a guy, and I'm embarrassed because I don't even remember his name, but he sent me a link to a guy, Jean-Noël Kapferer, who's a French expert in luxury goods. So suddenly I've got three books by a French expert in luxury goods that I'm reading. And then I go to JSTOR. I don't know if you know JSTOR. JSTOR is so much fun. It's a repository of academic papers. And I realized that he's written a whole bunch of stuff on. So, you know, I for everyone's benefit, Tom's still smiling, so I think it's okay to keep going. So, that, you know, it's the world is confusing, and we're foraging. And, you know, it's like asking the forager, do you look for green nuts and brown nuts? And it's like, well, I'm looking for any nuts that I can find. And then I try and taste them to figure out if they're poisonous. If they test bitter, maybe I'll leave them alone, you know. And so, yeah.
Makes sense.
And my answer to the puzzle, just, you know, I think that, you know, get out of the mentality that we get from schools and universities, where there's a reading list, where there's a set syllabus, where you cover it. No, we're exploring the Antarctic. We're exploring the polar regions. We're now on our own. And so trust yourself, trust your inner curiosity. Don't look for, in a certain way, in that regard, don't look for somebody to tell you what to do. Decide yourself. And in a certain way, maybe my answer to those two questions, this question and the previous one, is you're on your life's journey. Don't let somebody tell you what the path is. It's your path. And forgive me, I've said this many times. It's such a beautiful idea. And so everybody's listening to this, go buy every book by Joseph Campbell you can buy and read it. He's a really incredible, wonderful guy who married one of his students who was a dancer. But that be aside. So he says, and I believe it's him, I'm not an academic, so, you know, I got Steve Goldstein from MarketWatch telling me that this academic work that I've cited, it doesn't exist. Somebody's going to find out about this. But I'm reasonably sure that this is Joseph Campbell. He says, you enter the forest at the darkest place, where there is no path. Because if there was a path, it wouldn't be your path. And we each have to make our own path. And so, you know, in a certain way, underlying these questions is somebody saying to me, hey, Guy, what's the path? And my answer is, even if I knew the path, it's my path. You pick your path and don't ask me. I don't know for you. And actually, I would tell you that when I have people doing kind of research, they kind of will ask me that those kinds of questions. And I give them the same answer. I say, I don't want to tell you what to look at. I don't want to tell you what the right way to look at this industry is or which companies to look at even, because I want to find out what you think. I don't want to find out what I told you to think and whether you agree with it or not, or whether you, I want you to start from scratch, you know? So.
Yep. This one's hey, changing.
Look, I'll tell you, look, I'll give you, why do I like you, Tom? I'll tell you one of the reasons why I like you. Now, I'm asking a question and answering it. You're on your own path. You're leading. You are a leader. You don't know where you're going, but you know it's your path. I don't know exactly where it came from that you decided to do this podcast. I don't know where it came from that you decided to come to the Berkshire meeting, but you are on a path that it's clear to me that nobody is telling you what to do. You didn't wake up one day and say, I want to do a podcast. You know, I'm going to ask XYZ person how to do a podcast, how to run a YouTube channel, no, you're following your curiosity. It's so obvious. That's actually part of what makes it fun to talk to you, because you're alive, you're making decisions. You don't know what you'll be doing tomorrow in 3 weeks or 2 years from now, but you're exploring your forest in a certain way. And it's a beautiful thing when you get it, because you're kind of there doing it. And so that's my answer. And here's a mistake that I have made. It's not fatal, thankfully, but it's kind of like a serious mistake in life, is that I've made decisions as if I'm, because I was so in love with Warren Buffett, I've been making all these decisions in my portfolio that it doesn't come from exactly where I stand. It's maybe what somebody with Warren Buffett's resources would do if he was managing my portfolio, perhaps. But what is actually right for me? There are many small cap companies that I haven't looked at because I've been too busy aping Warren Buffett. But I have to actually look. It's my path. It's not Warren Buffett's path. It's not Lou Simpson's path. My path, you know, and to the extent that I found that, I've been better and more successful, and you're clearly on your own path. And so my exhortation to those two questioners, try and find a way to be on your path. And the way you get on that path is, is look inside yourself. You know, in the words of that famous book by the Google engineer, Search Inside Yourself, the answers are on the inside. Nobody knows which is the right step for you to take. Nobody knows which is the right textbook to pick up anymore. Nobody knows which is the right company to study. And you don't know yourself, but every now and then you'll get clues. You know, Tom has to decide who he's going to interview. And I know that Tom doesn't just do it based on how many views they get. He looks inside himself. You decide, what do my instincts tell me is the right way to go forward? It's a beautiful thing, actually. I just realized it right now. Back to you with a question.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say it's more fun to just do your own thing and talk to interesting people rather than just try to get the most clicks. But
here's what is really fascinating, Tom. That again, I'm not I'm a layperson in all of these things, but I know that there's a more than a kernel of truth in it. Is that your path? So curiosity is not just some weird thing that's out there. It's there's processes going on in our minds that are leading us somewhere good, somewhere that somehow deep inside ourselves or somewhere, wherever the hell it is. So follow your curiosity, because your curiosity will lead you to a good place. Follow your instincts. Don't assume that anything is extraneous and not something to be ignored. You know, that also goes for the negative sense, and I feel compelled to share this. I hope it's relevant in some weird way. So you know, you sit in a room, I'm in a room, somebody piques my curiosity, and a friend tells me, oh, that person's boring and not interesting. Don't listen to the friend, listen to the curiosity. Don't assume that the reason why that person caught your interest will be obvious to you right away. Follow that lead and see where it leads until you know that it's not the right path for you, and then stop. that also goes in the negative. The famous, or for me, this kind of impacted me so much to hear the story. So you're a woman, you've worked late at night, and you're leaving your office, say 9 o'clock, and you're on the 10th floor of a 20-story building, and you walk to the elevator. All that there is there a security guard downstairs, and you don't know if he's there anymore. Floors are deserted, and the elevator door opens, and there's a male figure standing in the elevator, and you get this feeling of, I don't know if that's safe. And then immediately, because let's say you're a woman living in a developed country, you say, this is ridiculous. I'm a female. I should feel safe leaving the office at 9 o'clock at night. I should not be worried about this shadowy male figure in the elevator. I'm going to step in the elevator. And self-defense says, you don't step into the elevator. Even though 999 times out of 1,000, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that man in the elevator. He bears no ill will to you, all those things. But you don't go into the elevator because one time out of 999, it could actually lead to an unpleasant circumstance. And all you have to do is step away, go to the bathroom, let the elevator pass, and stepped into a different elevator where there's no shadowy man standing inside. That's listening to your instincts. That's an act of self-defense in that case. And I was watching some self-defense course. That is an act of self-defense, listening to the instincts, not ignoring that feeling of, I'm not sure this is right for me, and overriding that feeling of, well, I should be allowed to do that, and just go with the self-defense and the instinct. On the positive side, don't let a friend or somebody who's well-meaning override those instinctual short thoughts about where you should be, because that will lead you to the promised land. And that's what's led you to kind of your promised land, because you're living the dream in a certain way, Tom. You're having a blast. I can see it. You're having so much fun, you know?
Yeah.
So, and it's special when you connect up to people like that. So, you know, it's strange. You ask these questions, you don't know where the hell it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, I've got absolutely no clue where this question's going to go. So this is one of our most thumbs-upped questions on YouTube. So it says, this is from James. He says, if Guy wasn't a fund manager, what would he be doing?
Yeah, it's a great question, James. The first thing that you need to know, and I say it, I've said it multiple times, and I say it with great seriousness. There are people like Monish Pabrai, who was an extraordinarily successful businessman. He sold his business. He put money in the bank, and then he started investing that money. I am in awe of people like that. I'm in a certain way a second generation of a relatively small but successful business run by my father. He was my first investor. If I had not been born into those circumstances, I'm not sure that I would have either been, you know, kind of to the extent that you think of what I'm doing as being entrepreneurial, I'm not sure that I would have been an entrepreneur. And I'm not sure that I would have been in the investment management business. I think I might have become an investment banker. And who knows where that would have led. Maybe I would have been some faceless, gray-suited guy working at Goldman Sachs or elsewhere, or trying to work in the, you know, trying to find my way to work for Jamie Dimon or a department blessed by Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan or something like that. I had been in the consulting industry, and I might have been in the consulting industry for the longest time. So I think that I might well have ended up in those places. I actually think that I'm really good in unstructured situations. I've seen in with not-for-profits, I'm capable of getting involved when the thing is just an idea and a sketch. And the minute the thing gets to fruition and it becomes kind of a solid thing, I have less of a role to play, and I'm actually not interested in playing a role. So maybe I would have been involved in the formation of startup companies. And I think that possibly where I would have ended up is as an academic and or teacher of some kind. And, you know, I don't know if I would have made it to being a tenured professor. So maybe I just would have been a lecturer or a teacher in some role or capacity, but maybe I would have ended up there. And then the last thought for James is that I think it's a really interesting question to ask, whose life would you like to be living? Not because one ought to live that life, but because it gives clues about what direction we should take in life. And I don't know why. I mean, it's come up for me less recently, but in the past, and it's not anything to do with investing, I I think that Steven Spielberg, I kind of like in a certain way, not so envious that I wanted to give up what I was doing, but the creation of these amazing stories and thinking through how to communicate on the deepest archetypal level with movies like Close Encounters and Star Wars, I believe, maybe that wasn't him actually, but some archetypal movies. You see, I don't know that much about the movie industry. More recently, the place where my envy goes is people who've been great essayists. So George Orwell, Montaigne. I just came across a book that I've just ordered, The Essays of Virginia Woolf. And so I find myself, and actually this guy, Paul Graham, who writes online, and actually another guy called David Perel, and I tell myself, or Tyler Cowen, there are people, you know, who've kind of think about the world and have written really insightful pieces about the world from a generalist standpoint. So, you know, that's something that I still aspire to be able to maybe do, but I don't know if I'll achieve it or succeed. It's extraordinarily hard to do. So I don't know if that helps, James.
That's very interesting. I had no clue where that answer was going to go. So that's cool to hear. let's do one more. You're quite well known for attending a certain lunch a few years ago. But we do have a question basically asking, and your answer may be the lunch you've already been to. I'm not sure, but the question essentially is, if you could choose three people dead or alive to have lunch with, who might they be?
Oh, what a great question. What a spectacular question. I haven't thought about that much recently. So with the caveat that this is not well thought through and kind of off the cuff, one of the first people that comes to mind who's actually historical is Abraham Lincoln. I think that he showed extraordinary and almost infinite wisdom in his actions, and so I think that he would have, you know, and I think that from all that I know about him and the one book that I've read about him and a couple of movies that I've seen, the capacity to uncover a wise action from a morass of difficulties is something that he seems to have repeatedly done through one of the most difficult periods of American history. So I think he's an extraordinary leader on a practical level, and I think that kind of appeals to me. Now, if we go to people who may be historical, maybe not, I mean, I would have liked to have talked to Moses, but then who wouldn't have liked to have talked to Moses? You know, he's in the Jewish tradition, there's kind of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our rabbi, you know? So there's questions about whether that human really existed. He's just a character in a work of literature called the Bible. So, but I'll throw him in there just for fun. But I think I should stay with historical figures. And it's funny because of, you know, Mahatma Gandhi comes up for me, but I almost feel like I know what he would say. And I think that in a certain way, he was kind of impractical. Yes, his nonviolence and wisdom worked in the British Empire, but I don't think it would have worked against the Russians. And I don't think it would have worked against the Nazis. And I don't think that, and he had this correspondence with Adolf Hitler, at least he wrote letters to Adolf Hitler, calling Adolf Hitler his friend. And I think that there was a kind of idealism there that was not justified. So my range over so many different places, and I kind of think of great historical figures. So, I would have liked him, but who would not want to have met Napoleon, you know, and to have talked to him and to have had that interaction, except that I think I would have become a worse person for having met with and talked to Napoleon, because he was his descendants aren't upset. He was kind of a nasty little man in a certain way. And it's not very nice of me to say little, but we know that he was short. And I'm kind of ranging around all over the place. I keep going to American presidents, but I've named, I have, maybe this betrays the time that I've spent in the US. Benjamin Franklin would have been an amazing guy to hang out with. no question, and hopefully to become friends with. You know, we people who Lee Kuan Yew has been mentioned many, many times, that guy uncovered enormous amounts of wisdom in himself. And I think that what's extraordinary about Lee Kuan Yew is that he himself would not have claimed to being a great intellect, if you like. So that kind of is special, because most of us don't have great intellects, but we still aspire to greatness. And so I think that Lee Kuan Yew is a guy who achieved greatness without having to rely on extraordinary intellect to get there. I think that what's interesting for me is, and I'll bring this little flight of fancy to a close, is that I'm not actually talking about the world's greatest minds, because in a certain way, many of the world's greatest minds have left a legacy in their writings that one is almost as good as being with them in life, if you like, because the best of their minds have been shared in writing. And so, you know, but I think that the people who have married insight with action and have been practical philosophers and have dealt with the world not from the safety of an ivory tower, even though they might have engaged with the world from that ivory tower in a very profound way. And another name comes up for me, Isaiah Berlin, who was a very beloved philosopher who many world leaders met with him because they wanted to get the interaction with him. But people who are out in the arena, I guess, you know, there's the famous quote by, I don't know which American president, the man in the arena. It's not the spectators, it's the man who's out there. So I think that the meetings with those people who actually lived the battle in one way or another of getting the right action but brought their thoughts to bear is kind of like inspiring. Shackleton. I would have liked to have met Shackleton. I could go on and on. You see, the more I think, the more people come up. But
yeah, you're going to have to get rid of a few to get back down to three now. But
exactly. It's not possible with any of them. So, you know, I'll just let it be.
Look, Guy, this was a lot of fun. I really appreciate your time and returning to the podcast. It's much appreciated. It's always a lot of fun talking to you, and I know people enjoy listening to what you've got to say as well. So I appreciate that. I know that you've already mentioned your letters are now publicly available. I know you've been a little more active on YouTube. I know you're on Twitter as well. Is there anywhere you want to plug before we wrap this up?
No, that's really kind. I'm I have to preface this with a famous statement, apparently by Golda Meir, Israeli Prime Minister. Have I told this to you already, Tom? So he's nodding. So Tom, soon you'll realize that I have just like a limited repertoire of things I just keep repeating. Just talk
I'm
to
not
my
sure
wife.
I've heard this tell one. You.
So Golda Meir, first woman prime minister that I know of, even before Margaret Thatcher, maybe not before Indira Gandhi in India, but so in a cabinet full of males. And she says, apparently reported, maybe somebody can find out if this is true or not and correct me if it's not and get me the quote if it is. But the story I have in my mind is she says to her cabinet, "Don't be so modest, you're not that great." Which, I don't know, there's a kind of like, you know, and they're all running around being falsely modest. And she's like, you know, you only get the right to be falsely modest when you're way greater. You know, Stephen Hawking gets to be falsely modest. Yeah. Mahatma Gandhi, you little ministers who just like sort of have crawled over each other to get a post in the Israeli government's cabinet, you don't get to be show modesty because you're not that great. And so I'm just amazed that people want to listen to me. And as I said to Tom a little bit just before, it's this, I'm kind of expecting the interest to drop off at some point. And it's like, yeah, well, guy's just repeating himself. I didn't learn anything new, so we'll see. But it's exciting for me as well, because and forgive me if this idea has already been expressed, but when we consume whatever, Google searches, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, our attention is being used by the algorithm. our attention is being delivered by the algorithm to people who are paying for our attention much of the time. But when we create content, even just a Twitter thread, you know, three takeaways from the Berkshire Hathaway meeting, three takeaways from the book that I read, when Tom creates content, when I agree to come and talk to you, then there's the possibility for the algorithm to be put to my use. So now the algorithm is going to take this content of me and Tom and feed it based on, you know, artificial intelligence, based on heuristics that we didn't even know exactly what they are. It's going to figure out, based on somebody else's activity, which of the 7 billion people on this planet need to watch this particular video. So I'm part of the benefit for me for doing this is that there is the, I was going to say the possibility, but it's actually the likelihood that I will get connected up to people that I otherwise would not have been connected up to that are going to be positive in my life. And so, you know, if you're one of those people, thank you for listening in and feel free to get in touch with me via any of the above mentioned channels. So there is a kind of a benefit. And I think my point is, to anybody who's listening to this, creating content is a non-zero-sum game, which is really beautiful. So, that you know, I have a podcast. The fact that I have a podcast does not detract from what Tom's up to at all. And if you learn something from Tom or from me or from elsewhere, you know, share it in whatever form you do. It doesn't matter. Share it in an essay, share it in a tweet, share it in a video, because you will now be putting the algorithm to use and for yourself, for your benefit. So I don't know. I could wax lyrical, Tom.
Guy,
I just made myself stop because I would have rambled on to something else, you know.
You're fine. This was a lot of fun, Guy, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Enjoy. Tell me and the viewers, what's it like in New Zealand right now? What's the weather like? What's the atmosphere? What's going on?
Yep, we're just coming into winter. So we finished our US trip in Texas, where it was about 35 degrees Celsius most days. And then I got off the plane in Auckland and it was like a frost, you know, car window was frozen the next morning type thing. So that was a little bit of a shock to the system. So we're just coming into winter, but we have very mild winters.
Are you planning on going skiing or anything?
I'm not much of a skier. I try to spend as much time as I can as far north as possible in New Zealand, where it's a little warmer. So
yeah,
that's where I tend to hang out.
And you know, if I can turn it around just for you a little bit, I don't know, sure. You maybe share this, but top present company excluded, top three meetings from the Berkshire Hathaway meeting, three people that had the biggest impact on you, and three things that you learned or three takeaways from you. This is really fun. I'm now interviewing Tom. Go on.
The Matt Peterson barbecue was a lot of fun. And then we spent, we spent a few hours with Matt in Austin. My friend Brandon recorded a video for his YouTube channel. We did a hour or so podcast with Matt and then, you know, went to lunch and everything. So it was a lot of fun hanging out with Matt. And what did we learn from Matt? We learned a lot of things about what the practicalities of running a fund, I guess. I knew a lot about his investment strategy, but it was interesting to hear about what running a fund is like. Had a good chat with William Green at your meet and greet, and then also a little bit at the dinner. We're actually, I've told the story on another podcast, but we're actually waiting for an Uber kind of straight after your dinner. I was waiting for an Uber to go to the place we were staying at, and I was chatting to William Green, and then Bill Gates just wandered past, which was a little bit of a surreal experience. But that kind of stuff happens in Omaha once a year, apparently. And met a ton of people just that watched the channel way more than I expected would kind of come up and say hi. So that was very cool. And we also got to stand in line with a guy called Brett Kelly. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Brett, but he runs an accounting firm that's listed on the Australian Stock Exchange called Kelly Partners. And he's a big Buffett fan. So it was interesting just kind of talking business at 4 in the morning in the Berkshire line with him too.
Did you say, and you, presumably you handed out business cards, received business cards, you've got ways of staying in touch with all of those people?
Yeah, I said just look me up, Investing with Tom, and my face will pop up somewhere.
That's really great. Well, it's fun to reconnect after the Berkshire meeting with you here, Tom. And as you can see, maybe next time I'll ask you more questions. You never
know.
Yeah,
that'd be good. Yeah, we'll turn the tables a little bit.
I should also just say thank you, because I think that you're providing a valuable service to many, many people. And I think that what you may not realize, or maybe you do, so you in a certain way are the subject of the podcast or the YouTube channel, because the audience tunes into your curiosity and they tune into your mind. And so what you become interested in and where your curiosity takes you is in a certain way part of the content. And so, you know, I urge you, I was saying it for other people, I urge you to kind of really sort of say, well, what am I curious about? What do I want to learn about? And follow that. And I don't know if, you know, I'll just re-mention him. Tyler Cowen's an amazing guy. And he's not a value investor, but he's a guy who does that very, very well. And another guy who does that very, very well, who I believe works at Microsoft, but he wrote a book about Charlie Munger called The Complete Investor, is Trent Griffin. What's lovely about Trent, and really I kind of tune into Trent's mind through Twitter, is that he's following what is interesting to him. But that is valuable content in and of itself. And one last person, oh God, I could keep going. Sorry, these are great resources that I urge you to follow, and maybe you can bring them up on your podcast, and maybe you can interview them. And other people like that, Paul Graham, I think I just talked about. He's an essayist, and he's a venture capitalist at Y Combinator. And Pat McKenzie, who works at Stripe, is also just a wonderful, wonderful guy. And again, each one of these people is their own person, and their curiosity and what they're interested in is part of the content. And that's what you are. So I'm interested to find out who you interview, because I'm interested to find out what you're interested in. So like this Kelly guy, you know, consider interviewing him. He's a CEO of a publicly traded company. I'm sure he'd be very interesting to interview, especially considering you met him at the Berkshire meeting. So,
yeah, we're definitely going to make that happen.
We're live now.
I'll send you the link.
Oh, you already interviewed him?
No, but no, we've got that planned. So when it's ready, I'll send you the link to it.
Yeah, but you know, and for the viewer, you know, if you were not at Berkshire, you missed the chance to meet Tom. And Tom is really just one hell of a personality. He's a lovely guy. I feel lucky to have met you, Tom. Really,
you're too kind. I'd better stop this episode before too many more compliments get out into the wide world. So.
In any case, I just had somebody pop their nose around the door. So, great. Thank you all for putting up with me. I hope I've been helpful. If I've insulted you, I apologize. If I was impatient or short with you, I also apologize. I'm a work in progress. You know, I'm not perfect in 1,000 different ways.
No, this was a lot of fun, Guy. We'll wrap it up here, but it's always good talking to you. And just hang on for a few seconds so that your videos upload as well, by the way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.